Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey, everybody. I have a very different one today, which by definition means for a change. My guest is Rob Delaney. Rob is best known as the co-creator, co-writer, and co-star of Catastrophe, the extremely popular and critically acclaimed Amazon sitcom, now seen in 130 countries. They did four brilliant seasons, and a number of years back, Rob was recognized at the Comedy Central Comedy Awards as the funniest person on Twitter, which is no mean feat because there are, I would imagine, literally thousands of people on Twitter. But his tweets were sometimes I put dog poop in the toilet at work so the guys don't think I only went in there to cry. And after he won that coveted award, Rob wrote a book, Mother, Wife, Sister, Human, Warrior, Falcon, Yardstick, Turban, Cabbage. That was both very funny, but also very dark and frank about his struggles with alcoholism and depression. Now, my daughter gave me that book mainly because she really liked it, and I loved it. And at the time, I was depressed. This was not long after I left the Senate, and I did not know Rob, and I still really don't know him. But at one point there, I got his email, and I can't recall how, but I emailed him to see if we could talk. And he wrote back that he couldn't really do that and it wasn't a good time for him. And I learned not long after that his two-year-old son, Henry, was dying from a brain tumor. And you know, I felt stupid that I had contacted him. Then about 6 months ago, I learned that he had written the book that we're discussing on this podcast, The Heart That Works, about Henry being diagnosed shortly after his first birthday and the next 18 months of his life and of his family's life. Henry had two older brothers, little boys. I was just blown away by how raw and honest and angry and funny sometimes. You see, I'd been sent an advance copy of A Heart That Works, and I emailed Rob again and asked if he could join me as a guest to discuss A Heart That Works, and he wrote back saying that he'd love to. And in that email, he apologized for not getting back to me when I'd first written him, and I responded that that was the most ridiculous apology ever written. And I think you can tell that this one is very different, and I really think you'll be kind of blown away by this one for a change. Before we start that conversation, just going to comment on a couple developments this week. The Respect of Marriage Act, made necessary by this illegitimate 6-3 Supreme Court. In his concurring opinion on Dobbs, Clarence Thomas wrote that the court should revisit Obergefell, the 2015 decision which legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. When Obergefell passed the court, I wrote a press release that I ran by my chief of staff and communications director, and this is it. Senator Al Franken, Democrat of Minnesota, applauded the Supreme Court today in its decision on Obergefell, legalizing same-sex marriage nationwide, but called Justice Antonin Scalia's dissent, quote, very gay. And they wouldn't let me put it out, which I regret. Our progress on this is interesting. In 1996, President Bill Clinton signed the Defense of Marriage Act, which said that the federal government would not recognize same-sex marriage. When Barack Obama ran in 2008, he was against legalizing same-sex marriage nationally. Now, I ran that same cycle. The evening before I announced, and this is in February 2007, Franny and I had a number of our friends and supporters over to our place in Minneapolis, and I told them what we were up to. And a good friend of ours who was kind of a mucky muck in the human rights campaign, that's the largest LGBTQ lobbying organization in the country, and he said, oh, don't say you're for same-sex marriage, you'll lose. And I said, well, I got a problem, which is that I am for same-sex marriage, and I think my approach to all of this is that I'm going to just say what I'm for and what I'm against. You know, especially on issues like this one, I'm just for marriage equality. And not 2 weeks later, I was asked at some press forum about it, and I said I was for marriage equality and gave all the reasons for it, which is that everyone should have the same rights and be able to see your spouse in the hospital and get insurance together and raise kids. I was the first major party statewide candidate in Minnesota history to say I was for marriage equality. And it caused a bit of a hubbub, but really only among Democrats. And their only problem was, well, can he win? Not is it the right thing to do, but can he win? And that lasted all of a day or two. And that was it. Again, this is February of 2007. We had almost 2 years till the election. And I don't think it ever came up again. Every new Democratic candidate who entered that race took the same position. And after I got the nomination, my Republican opponent, the incumbent Senator Norm Coleman, never brought it up. And not really to his credit, there were just a lot of bigger fish to fry. We were into our seventh year in Iraq, and you'll recall the economy collapsed. So the country had moved on, or so it seemed. Last week, 12 Republican senators voted for the Respect for Marriage Act. But that means that 38 of them didn't. Really? I mean, come on. Okay, and then there's all this anti-Semitism. After Trump had Thanksgiving with Kanye West and this Holocaust-denying white nationalist, Nick Fuentes, I texted a couple of my former Republican colleagues and said, you know, you guys really ought to, like, condemn this. And what I heard back was, no, the more you talk about, you know, this guy and West, and the more popular they become. And I'm thinking, really? And very few Republicans said anything. And then 3 days later, Kanye West, and that's what I just call him, I guess it's Ye, he says, I like Hitler. And I'm not sure whether Kanye is a Holocaust denier or just a big fan of the Holocaust. I mean, what's not to like? Okay. Can you former Republican colleagues of mine, please condemn him now? No? No? Really? Well, lots of other stuff going on. An unstable, weird, not smart guy running for the Senate in Georgia with a chance of winning. Brutal, obscene war in Ukraine. We got a jerk running Twitter now. So let's go to my conversation with Rob Delaney. I think you'll find this one very moving, very sad, but so full of love and heart, mixed with a lot of wisdom, some very raw emotion, and some laughs, you know, for a change.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
You're someone who's ready with your emotions. I mean, that's what the book is largely about. And you'll go in the space of a sentence to fury and anger to something hilarious. Here's something you say about God. Can I read this thing to you? And maybe,
oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
With the death of my blue-eyed son, Henry, I often found myself driven by the urge to believe in God so I could live to a very old age, then die and meet him, so I could kick his teeth in.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a cockroach. I wanted to survive all the horror and the drudgery and the pain. Didn't even want to do it happily. I just wanted to endure what shouldn't be endured and crawl on elbows and knees over the finish line and tell God to fuck off. Thoughts like that generally made me smile at the time. And but I gotta say, the first time through, I wasn't laughing at that shit.
Sure.
I was just crying.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would read this to my wife, and I would start crying. And she'd go, come on. So Henry is a year old, just short of a year, and he starts vomiting.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was interesting. I was this weekend with some friends. One is a doctor, and I told her the story about the pediatrician who is older.
Yeah.
And he's the one who finally figured it out.
Right.
And he asked you about, was the vomiting, how did he put it?
He asked me if it was effortless, is the word that he used, which was an important distinction because, you know, if you vomit because you've got the flu, you might be thinking, oh God, am I going to puke? And, you know, trying to not puke and fighting it. And then it's a bodily, pretty horrible thing that originates in the gut and is not pleasant. But with Henry's vomiting, it was, as the doctor put it, effortless. It was, he all of a sudden just, everything would come up and out. And there wasn't the retching that accompanied normal vomiting. And, you know, I would later learn the reason for that was that the tumor in his head was creating pressure on the emetic center of his brain. So essentially just a button that said vomit immediately was being pushed in his head. So it didn't, you know, kind of go through the normal process that our vomiting goes through when we vomit. And so that really concerned the doctor. And it was then that he suggested an MRI of his head.
And you said to him,
I said, why to see if there's something in his head that shouldn't be there, like a tumor, you know, incredulous. And he said, I'm glad you said it.
And a cancerous one.
Yeah.
And one that required surgery. Now you're going all this, you're in Great Britain.
We are London. Yeah.
You're in London, and all this is done through the NHS.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Which you have incredibly high regard for.
And I do.
And if you read the book, so will the reader.
Yeah.
The care that you guys got, mm-hmm. And the caregivers, is amazing.
Yeah.
And something that, you know, I think that in this country you would get a lot of that, but it's a use. And maybe this isn't the point of this conversation to get into it, but to talk about our two different healthcare systems.
Oh, I'm very happy to. I talk about that. I bet a lot of people wish I would shut up about it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I was on the Health Education, Labor, and Pension Committee. So, I was there for the ACA when I got to the Senate. We didn't have it. I was the 60th vote, and so we were amazing. Able to get it.
Yeah.
But one thing, I don't know if you know, but you're pretty politically aware and literate.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we could have gotten Medicare for All or Medicaid.
Yeah.
For all who want it.
Yeah.
It was called a public option.
Yeah.
But Joe Lieberman, we had 60 votes. We needed 60 to pass this thing. Everybody had a veto, and Joe Lieberman vetoed that.
Yeah. Not a good. So, no. Thanks for nothing. Thanks for nothing, Joe.
Yeah. You know, that was terrible because
truly a sin.
Because we do have different systems and we have different histories evolved, and you swear by the NHS in this, and rightly so, because you got extraordinarily beautiful care and from you got help. Some of the heroes in this are the folks that took care of Henry.
Yeah, one thing I would say is, you know, I'm sure I have not been in the hospital too much anytime recently in the United States. But, you know, my dad was and he got great care. And you can certainly get wonderful care in the United States. I mean, nurses are tremendous and doctors are good at what they do. And so you'll get great care in the United States usually. But the thing that the NHS did is that it removed all those phone calls with the insurance companies that you have in the United States. Even when you are getting good care, you're devoting a certain amount of time each week or month or day in an intense situation saying, hey, listen, please approve this MRI. Or, hey, I went to the pharmacy and they wanted $615. Oh. Because my prescription plan was sold to another company, unbeknownst to me, that happens sometimes. And they messed up in the transfer my login information. So now they want $650 cash for this liquid that my son desperately needs right now, today. So the amount of time that I got to spend with Henry, playing with him, holding him, kissing him, you know, dancing around to West Side Story with him and all that amounted to a lot in the course of his illness. So yeah, it's not that you can't get great care in the United States. You often can, and frequently people do. It's just that we didn't have to waste colossal hours on clerical work and administrative work and get the stomach churning fear of, is this going to go through? Can I afford? Do I hit the deductible? Mm-hmm. All the insane questions that you have to waste a tremendous amount of time on in a country that, you know, really ought to be doing better by its citizens.
The time you spend with Henry is so valuable to you, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh, and, God, yeah. And, you know, and you made a decision, you and Leah is your wife?
Yeah.
Made a decision to take care of each other and your other two other boys.
Yeah.
And make sure that all your attention didn't just pour just into Henry, although it does.
Yeah, I guess we sort of realized early on, I don't know, we, you know, taking stock at the end of one day or something, early on realized, hey, this is going to hit. You know what? I actually saw a documentary about brain injuries done by Louis Theroux. This was early in Henry's illness. And I remember being struck by the fact that all the families surrounding the patients of the people with brain injuries were changed very dramatically, and all their relationships were changed. And everybody was so affected because of the disabilities that can accompany a brain injury and the personality changes that can come with it. So family dynamics can really change, in particular with a brain injury. So since Henry was so changed by his illness and surgery, we were like, okay, guess we should probably also look out for each other and for the other kids, because we've got, you know, a tidal wave is taking us somewhere else, somewhere different. And so we did, thank goodness, from fairly early on, know that the other kids still needed hugs, cuddles, attention, happy meals, play dates, all that stuff. And we realized, you know, that our marriage, my wife and I, would falter or collapse if that didn't receive attention at the same time. Even though it might not be convenient that we had to do that, we still had to do it. And so thank goodness we did.
And when you say the effect of a brain, you know, tumor or brain illness, on the way it changed Henry was what he could do physically. But it was the brain stem and not the frontal lobe. And so he stayed Henry. He was Henry.
He did. You're right.
You know, the picture you paint of this boy who is sweet and joy and fun and beautiful, even when, I mean, and the challenges you had, the fact that when they did the surgery, he lost the ability to swallow. He couldn't speak, so he learned to sign. But my God, what a beautiful child. And what a...
Oh, yeah.
And wrench. I mean, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. Tell the story of your son. Well,
yeah, I mean, everything you've said is accurate and correct. One thing I would add is how hard he worked after his surgery to learn things like sign language at the age of one, or how hard he worked in physical therapy to regain skills was just astonishing. I mean, every physical therapy session with him felt like an Olympic gold medal moment to watch him work so hard. It was really inspiring. And it was also, you know, I don't think a one-year-old does like what we might need to do in a difficult situation, like, ooh, let's get psyched up, you know, pep talk time, like, I gotta do this. It was just the life force in him was so powerful and aspirational and robust. It was just really, really glorious. And that's why, I mean, there's 1,000 reasons why his death devastated us, but one thing that really hurts is to think of how hard he worked and cancer still killed him, you know.
Yeah, he wasn't an asshole during this.
No. He burned a lot of calories doing and learning stuff. So it was really beautiful.
As I said, the first time through the book, I didn't laugh much, but the hardest I laughed, you had to take this trach out once a week and replace it, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes
once a month. Yeah.
Once a month. Okay. And sometimes it bled.
Yeah.
And you tell this story about, I guess, maybe a year after Henry passed, that you're in an action movie. A comedy action movie.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where someone has to get shot in the throat.
Yeah.
Can you tell that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm doing the show and, you know, people get killed in it. And at one point, my character is to witness someone getting shot in the throat. You know, I'd read the script. I knew it was coming and getting ready for it and stuff. And then the day we were going to shoot that, I could feel myself starting to get nervous and like really bodily nervous, you know, like really concerned, like, am I going to be able to do this? And so I went over to the director and the showrunner and I said, listen, guys, I got to tell you something about what we're going to shoot today and how I'm feeling about it. In taking care of Henry, we would have to change his tracheostomy tube once a month. And sometimes that could be a bloody affair. And, you know, more than a few times I saw blood come out of a hole in his throat that was, in fact, the circumference and size of a bullet hole. So I'm really nervous about today. And they both looked, you know, like ghosts. And they were like, oh, my God, that's okay. Wow. Yes. So sorry. We had no idea. And they were, you know, they're good guys. And they were like, what can we do? Should we? And I was like, you know what? Honestly, even telling you about it and seeing you give a shit makes me feel better. You know, I got rid of that big, bad secret. I think I can do it. And then there was one of the guys like, no, that's, I don't know. Listen, should we shoot her in the face? No, you can shoot her in the throat. I mean, it's what it says in the script, and that's cool. That'll look cool. And people are going to like that. You know, that's good TV. Shoot her in the throat. And they were like, okay.
We could shoot her in the face.
It was just so funny. Yeah. The idea that a guy's idea to help me in a loving manner, you know, as a guy who by this point is my friend, is like, yeah, should we shoot her in the face?
That had me laughing. Yeah. That was a big laugh for me.
And all credit to my wife. I told her that when that happened, I was like, honey, listen to this. And she's like, get off the phone with me right now and go write that down. That must go in the book. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I wrote it
down. No, that was, you know, because now there was another path. Can you read from the book? Do you have the book in front of you? Can you?
I could. Let's see. I don't know how the audio quality will be if I do that. How am I sounding right now?
You sound fine. Okay. I don't know if there's an American version of the book versus a British, but mine, what on 46 of the Heart That Works, I dream about Henry often.
Yeah.
I dream he's alive. Can you read that?
Okay.
Because I can't read it myself without without crying.
Sure. I dream about Henry often. I dream he's alive. And in those dreams, it's not as though he was never sick. He's the Henry that might have survived some possible future where he still needed help with a few things. So in my dreams, I'm still caring for him. We do things together. I even take him with me to work. In some dreams, he's recovered. And sometimes his cranial nerves have been repaired somehow. And it all works out. He runs into his mother's arms. He plays with his brothers or even fights with them. And I love it all. Other times I'll dream about a terribly wounded animal that I'm frantically trying to fix, but I don't have the proper tools. I wake myself up crying and struggling to breathe. I love these dreams. They hurt like hell and terrify me and make me feel close to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's true. You know, yeah, that's not a pleasant sort of dream to have, but, you know, I feel
still love it because you feel close to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's now you have three boys again. I mean,
yeah,
you've had four boys. You've had four boys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But he's still with you every day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't think I say this. I don't know if I do in the book or not, but yeah, Henry, despite being dead, still receives roughly 25% of my parenting energy, along with his other brothers, because, yeah, I mean, he'll always be my son. I'll always be his dad. You know, I don't understand the parameters of our relationship now. There's a much, much more mystery in our relationship, but it's certainly still very real.
Well, yeah. And how old are your boys now?
11, 9, and 4.
The 11 and 9-year-old. The 4-year-old was born not long after Henry died, but the older boys, Oscar
Eugene.
Eugene, that's right. What's their relationship to their memory of their brother or their...
Yeah, well, so they were not quite four and not quite six when he died. You know, they had birthdays right after. In fact, with Oscar, there was a big sense of relief when Henry died on my birthday, because it meant that he wasn't going to die on Oscar's birthday, which is a few days later. Mm-hmm. So many feelings about having my son die on my birthday. One of them is, oh, thank God he didn't die on his brother's birthday. Because, you know, when you're a little kid, your birthday is important to you. And I didn't want to have, you know, a sort of second lower grade, but still mm-hmm. shitty thing happen. You know, they took incredible care of Henry. You know, they learned how to operate his liquid feed and set it up through his stomach tube at night. Under my observation, I absolutely let my three-year-old operate advanced medical equipment and care for his brother. And he was very proud to do it. He took great care in it and did a great job. So they were, you know, as close to him in life as any brothers have ever been anywhere. And then now they talk about him. You know, Henry's spoken about openly in our home. You know, there's pictures all over the place. You know, our four-year-old still eats in Henry's sort of kind of weird orthopedic Swedish high chair that Henry would sit in when we ate dinner. You know, our not disabled four-year-old uses that and is too big for it, but we don't know how to get rid of it. And yeah, they talk about him all the other time. Yeah, the nine-year-old had a cardboard box that some package came in the other day, and he wrote the word tumor on it and took it out in the back garden and stabbed it with a kitchen knife. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's cool and good and healthy. And so they have anger about it and sadness. Our 11-year-old can speak a little more freely about him. Our 9-year-old, it more comes up kind of in storms, because they were so close in age and size and, you know, just had that easy intimacy that little tiny people who share DNA have, you know, and so he'll get very angry and upset about it or sad, and as he should, you know, and we hold him and love him and, you know, tell him how wonderful he was with Henry and how much Henry loved him and how being sad and angry are perfectly okay. We don't, you know, we hold him, but we don't tell him, you know, they're there, it'll be okay. I think more maybe we show him it'll be okay by letting him cry or swear or stab a box that says tumor on it. And yeah, well,
you've modeled a lot of this too, by the way they see you handle it. And part to me, as a fan of catastrophe, one of the things that, you know, doing a comedy show while this is happening, what seasons of the show did you do while you knew Henry that had the tumor and was sick?
He got diagnosed in between seasons 2 and 3. So after a while, because I had to work, because we live in central London and we didn't really get paid well until season 3, I couldn't afford to not work. So season 3, we rented a little office very close to Great Ormond Street Hospital where Henry was. And we wrote that, and I could go to the hospital as needed. And then we shot it. And then after that,
I just want to ask you about that.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is, and I'm sure everyone is curious how you do a comedy show. And I think I know this. I wrote comedy and, and you can write comedy, and sometimes writing comedy is a relief. Not only you're writing it, you're the producer, you're the star, co-star with Sharon Horgan, who's just what a partnership, what a brilliant.
Very lucky, very, very, very lucky to have had that partnership.
Well, it's amazing. I'm
very grateful.
It's amazing. It's a man, woman comedy writers,
yeah,
and actors and yeah, comedian, and doing a show that is just, it's a unique show, has your voice and her voice, mm-hmm, which yeah, we haven't seen before. We haven't seen those voices, and especially put together. And mm-hmm, it's a huge international hit. It's in more countries than there are countries, right?
Yeah, when I hear that stat, I'm like, I couldn't name all those countries. I think that maybe somebody got a little creative in the number.
How many countries do they say it's in?
It says 130 countries.
There are not 130 countries.
Or shouldn't be. That's too many.
I can't. Do you like, are you? I know the answer to this, which is you don't do this, which is like, I want to know who's dubbing me in Kenya.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, I mean, that's one of those things like, oh, I'd love to know that. I'm not going to find it out, but sure, theoretically, that's like one of those, like when I was a teenager, I used to wonder, like, could I ever ask God how many beers I've drank? You know, like, you know, yeah, that's not something I'm ever going to find out, but it'd be neat to know.
You drank a lot of beers.
I did drink a lot of beers.
So that would be
God,
I was, you know, the joke about the Irishman who finds the genie, you know, the bottle, the genie, and rubs it, and the genie says three wishes.
Which one?
It was his Irishman gets the genie, and the genie says he has three wishes, and he says, well, all of the potatoes in Ireland. Poof. You know this joke?
Mm-hmm. No, not yet.
Okay. Well, and there's a mountain of potatoes appear.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, okay, now you have your second wish. You have three. He goes, okay. All of the potatoes in the world. and boom, there's a mountain, several mountain ranges of potatoes. Yeah. He goes, okay. he says to the Irishman, your third wish. And he goes, more potatoes.
I love that.
So with you, it might have been all the beer.
yeah, could have been.
you write about that, especially in you write about that in Mother, Wife, Sister, Human, and you write about all
the other stuff,
and all the other stuff, and depression, and it's hilarious. Mm-hmm. It has a mix, unlike only like a Rob Delaney book, and so this one does too. Tell me about the caregivers and how unbelievable they were, and the reaction of one in particular when you told her that the tumor came back.
Yeah. So when Henry got out of the hospital, he needed care at home as well, due to the fact that he had what they call an unsafe airway. Because he was two, he couldn't be responsible for the care of his state-of-the-art tracheostomy tube with an inflatable cuff on the inside of it. And it's, you know, very amazing development, but also it can go from zero to deadly in a second if there's an obstruction or anything goes wrong. So at that age, you can't even sleep unaccompanied. And so for that reason, he needed to be watched while he slept by a live human being. There wasn't like a monitor that you could hook up, because he could roll over. You know, you're not going to staple him to the bed each night. So he rolls over, something gets obstructed. So, you know, there's what here is called social care, you know, home care, which our council, borrow might be another word for it, provides. And so he had somebody that would just sit in the corner of his bedroom in our house and watch him sleep. And the people who did this were really wonderful. You don't have to be a fully qualified nurse. You know, you don't have to be an RN or anything to do this. You have to have a few, you know, they call them bands. You have to achieve a certain band level to be alone with a kid who has a tracheotomy. And of course, first, it's weird to have somebody in your house in the middle of the night who you might, you know, see when you go to pee at, you know, 2:15 a.m. or whatever. But Christ, do I still wish they were here now, you know, and that, because that would mean that Henry was alive. But yeah, these are wonderful people who, you know, are not being paid a big fat hourly rate, who made it possible for my wife and I to sleep at night so that we could then parent Henry during the daytime and the evening and the early morning, you know, and his other brothers as well, and work, you know, and live. Without them, we wouldn't have been able to function. I don't know what would have happened, but I promise it would have been bad. You know, we would have screwed up in his care due to fatigue at some point. So that was a wonderful, wonderful thing. You know, that fell under the auspices of what they call social care over here, which, you know, Medicaid might provide in the United States for certain people who are quite disabled. And the thing that you're talking about is one of his night cares, a woman named Rachel, was caring for him the night after we found out that his tumor had returned and that he was going to die. And I, you know, took her aside and I said, I need to tell you that, you know, we got the results of Henry's MRI and it's bad. His cancer has returned. And, you know, kind of let that sit for a second. And there is not anything that they can do at this point. And he is going to die. After a moment, Rachel began to really yell and say, oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, no, God, no. Oh, Christ, no. And I was just blown away by her response. I mean, I really loved it. It really made me feel sane and normal and good, because she was having, you know, quite a visceral response to, you know, the worst type of news I've ever had to deliver to anyone. And of course, I had to tell a lot of people that. And I did not get any responses that were as good as that one. And yes, of course, I ranked them.
Of course.
You know. and
there's so much of that.
Yeah.
In the book, too. That, yeah. That's what, when you tell this story about Rachel, you're mm-hmm. loving and grateful. Mm-hmm. But so much of the book is also dark and angry.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And railing at people, you know, who don't. Do you have advice for, well, like one of the pieces of advice you have for people is, what can I do for you?
Yeah. Yeah. Or yeah. If there's anything I can do. Yeah.
If there's anything I can do.
Yeah.
And what is your advice to those?
You know, when you ask that question, you're asking that for you. You're checking a little sort of emotional clerical box for yourself. That's not for them. Because what you can do is go run home and make a mediocre casserole quickly and then deliver it to their house, you know, or go wrestle them to the ground, take their socks and shoes off and give them a foot massage that they, you know, their feet probably haven't been touched by another person in some time, you know, rub their feet, clip their toenails, you know what I mean? Go clean their kitchen. You know, that, I mean, what that would do for somebody in a situation like that, I mean, you can't put a price tag on that. People often say like, oh, what should I say in this situation? And the answer to that really is nothing. There's nothing you can say, as expressed more eloquently by Mary Shelley in her wonderful book, Frankenstein, which I talk a lot about in the book. But no, there's nothing, there's no words that can help. There are actions that can help a lot. And you know what they are. They're the things that you'd like to have done for you when you're in extremis.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Rob Delaney.
It's 3 o'clock somewhere. Time for a My Mochi ice cream snack. My Mochi ice cream is cool, creamy scoops of premium ice cream wrapped in sweet, pillowy dough. And get this, all of My Mochi's fabulous flavors, like strawberry, mango, double chocolate, and cookies and cream, are only around 80 calories per piece. Talk about a guilt-free, indulgent experience. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned, gluten-free mochis that are great for grab-and-go. So feel good while curbing your afternoon cravings or the midnight munchies. Yeah, you know who you are with the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream. Find My Mochi ice cream at Target or visit MyMochi.com to locate a grocery store near you.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's what happens when you give Grammarly to your entire team. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
We're back with Rob Delaney. We're talking about his book, A Heart That Works.
How's your dad? Is your dad very sick, right? Or is he?
Yeah, well, Al, I'll tell you that 3 days after the book came out in the UK, my dad, Bob, died. And I was with him. In a nursing home in Boston. I barely made it there. I had been with him a lot over the last year, which had been wonderful. And yeah, he got leukemia. He had it for 2 years. It started out as a sort of less intense blood cancer. And then about a year ago, it turned into a couple types of leukemia. And then he died just a month ago now.
You write in the book about this, and this is very typical of kind of the honesty in the book of sort of like going, you're 71 or however old he was. You're supposed to die. Right? I mean, that's sort of the tone I want the listener to understand, because it's that's what strikes me about this book, is that you write about your dad probably dying, and you just go like, okay, fine.
So, you know, I mean, it's a complex sort of stew of emotions.
All and, of this is.
So a big sad aspect of it for me is that as my dad took such incredible care of Henry, he was here in London all the time, and he became highly skilled. He became one of the very few people who was allowed to be alone with Henry, not by us, but just by, like, you know, medical protocol for Henry's situation, due to how much he learned about pediatric tracheotomies and caring for them. So he was just amazing. So in addition to missing my dad, whom I love desperately, it's also a link to Henry that has now, I don't want to say gone, but, you know, metamorphosized to a whole new thing that I'm, you know, working to understand and probably never will. So losing your 74-year-old dad is not as grueling and brutally awful as losing your 2-year-old child, because it's more the natural order of things. So
I'll read a sentence from the book.
Okay.
This is about that. And you go, but I was never, ever far from the thought, this is what's supposed to happen. What happened to Henry wasn't supposed to happen.
Yeah.
I'm a grandpa.
Yeah.
And man, oh man. I'd if I were him, I'd agree.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you said dad, I'm sorry. I'm really sad. I love you. You've been a great dad or not, but you've been a great dad. And, I'm so sad you're going, but you know, and if I were him, I go, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. My wife's dad, said early after we discovered that Henry had the tumor, you know, he said, I wish it was me. And I said, we all do, Richard.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And everybody and, laughed, right?
Everybody laughed.
Yes, that's, I recall that. That's a healthy,
I mean, humor
in that family.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, there's some families where they get mad.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we can get mad at each other for our weird idiosyncrasies, you know, and I'm sure we would do stuff where we'd be like, well, glad I'm not in that family. But in that realm, we're doing all right.
You're a member of a club, parents who've lost their kids.
Yeah. Yeah. I sure am now. Yeah.
You know, are a lot of your, do you bond with those folks? And is that something that's a big part of your life, or if you move?
Oh, yeah. It's very, very important to me. You know, I swam this morning in a local pond with another bereaved mom that I met through my bereaved parents group. And I started doing that because my wife has always done that. And there's a community. It's all moms. None of the bereaved dads swim, okay. But I like to swim. So I go, but I really love spending time with parents who've lost kids. Cause you know, we could just communicate on a sort of deeper level. We just have a sort of baseline, I guess, that we're operating from. That,
so it's always there, but at the same time, you have the same laughter, you have the same everything that everybody else has, mm-hmm. but it's also there.
Yeah, and I don't have to explain it or sort of even, and I try not to like.
And yet I'm asking you to explain it.
No. I mean to say like, that's what this is for. You know what I mean? One day, if you can deliver your podcast through a smell that enters an older part of the brain,
okay.
And words do, you know, we'll do it that way. But for now, this is the best we can do. And, but like sometimes if I'm talking to someone who hasn't lost a kid, I might try to sugarcoat something even unconsciously, cause I don't want to horrify them, you know, but with I don't have to waste that energy when I'm with another bereaved parent. I can just go for it. And they're like, yeah, oh God, of course. Yeah. I felt the same way. Or, oh yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah, you're right. And so it's just a little easier to, I don't know, let down my hair, so to speak, with people who get that, but it doesn't have to be, you've lost a kid. You know, I've had the good fortune recently to, become friends with a guy who's a veteran of multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan because of the stuff that he's been through, both on the battlefield and then with his own mental health, with reentry and leaving the military and reentry into civilian life. You know, he and I can chat about, you know, we can go deep fast, and it's a very easy communication. But I do find it's easier for me to relax with people who've, at least had a glimpse. Trauma. Yeah, who've had a glimpse into the mouth of hell. Yeah. People who have experienced things that would be like, for example, on your top five list of things you wouldn't want to experience. You know what I mean? That anybody wouldn't, you know.
Let's lighten it up. I want to talk about the sex scenes in Catastrophe.
Of course, yes. A natural segue. A
yeah. Yeah. Which I always thought were interesting because it was never like, let's make love.
Yeah.
That's I love you, darling.
Yeah.
It was let's have sex.
Yeah.
And the way you depicted it, we saw your ass a lot.
Yeah. Too much, perhaps. Yeah.
Well, some people would say never too much. Some others might say way, way, way too much. Yeah. But one of my favorites was when you had the neck brace.
Oh, and, God. Yeah.
And she didn't want to see it.
Yeah.
And then.
Yeah.
So you arranged a kind of. So she didn't have to look at you.
Precisely. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That is. And yeah. Then, but then she saw you in a reflection.
I know. God.
Goddamn, that was funny. And this, you guys are fucking hilarious together.
Oh, thank you.
And also, thanks. What I liked about it is that you are both at times awful to each other.
Yeah.
And what I love about you
yeah. is
that you embrace. How, you know, in that show and in your books, and mm-hmm. you talk about fucking up all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, we all do, you know. It's funny because that reminds me of a line that Sharon's character said that I happen to know that happens to come out of my pen, which was she's yelling at Rob. And it's me yelling at me is what is happening.
Right. Cause you were.
And she says, good people hurt other people. That's part of being an adult, you know? And, it happens, you know, not everybody has to like you all the time. And that to me really sums it up. If you survive to adulthood and then middle age and beyond, part of your journey is going to be hurting other people. That does not mean that you're consigned to hell forever. And it's profoundly unfortunate if you don't have, find, or create the opportunity to correct course and fix things, but you're not irredeemable because you've hurt people. You're a human being because you've hurt people, and you hurt people because you're human. You can't not. Unless you live alone in a mountain, and then you're probably breaking the heart of your mom or whatever, and you're hurting her that way. But like, we're going to hurt people. And then the cool thing about being a human being is that we can fix it, or at least try to. And so, yeah, that was one thing we wanted to convey in Catastrophe, was that nobody's beyond the pale, and beyond help and beyond love, you know? So that was Catastrophe. Some people say like, oh God, you know, like I'd so watch that and think, oh, I'm glad I'm not in that relationship. And to me, it's like, okay, if that's how you feel. But for me, Catastrophe is a show about love and about doing the daily maintenance. And then when you're not doing the daily maintenance, about grappling with that and then trying to go back and cram and fix it, which you can't. And so then you have to, you know, do something, have to have a big paradigm shift to fix it. And so, yeah, Catastrophe for me is a love story. And it's not a sexy one. It's like an endurance one. And it's like the marathon of love stories rather than a sprint.
Well, there's a sensibility, the same sensibility in the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is an amazing book to me.
Well, thank you.
You're an amazing writer. And you have an ability to find in yourself and all these different conflicting feelings and emotions and anger and rage and pain and love in a way that I haven't seen anyone else do, but it's you. It's other people have done that, believe me, in the history of literature, but but you do it in your way that I just find remarkable and is a gift.
You're very kind. Thank you. And I've admired you for decades. So to hear it from you means a lot. So thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients, popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.
The early 2000s was a wild time for reality TV. There seemed to be an endless supply of shows that delivered entertainment for us, but trauma for children. I'm Misha Brown, the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Each week on The Big Flop, comedians join me to chronicle the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? We recently looked behind the scenes of what was really going on at Abby Lee Miller's dance studio. Abby's biggest misstep wasn't screaming nonsensical catchphrases or throwing chairs on television, but instead, she was choreographing financial fraud in plain sight. Join me to break down all the wild details of Abby Lee Miller's story. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.